You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Dr. Arthur D. Bradley, a NASA engineer. Dr. Bradley, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Bradley, I just read your book, Disaster Preparedness for EMP Attacks and Solar Storms, the expanded edition, and I want to get into that in a moment. But before we do, for the benefit of the listeners, can you tell them a little bit about your background?
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, I work for NASA. I work out of Langley Research Center in Hampton, Virginia. My title there is I'm the Assistant Branch Head for the Electronic Systems Group. And my background in general is in electronics and electromagnetics, which fit pretty well with this topic. I used to work at the University of Tennessee as a professor in that area as well. I've got four kids. We homeschool all of them, and I have a wide assortment of interests, including martial arts, firearms, traveling, things like that.
I have done some interviews with experts in EMP, which is electromagnetic pulse, so I'm a little bit ahead of the curve here compared to your average American, unfortunately, as you lay out in the book. But let the listeners know exactly what is EMP and how can it occur.
Sure. Well, EMP is just a term, like you mentioned, electromagnetic pulse. And so it can be caused by a wide variety of things. Most of them are not what people are talking about when they talk about EMP attacks. But certainly lightning or any high current electrical discharge can cause an electromagnetic wave that comes across as a pulse. Most of the time, it doesn't disrupt anything seriously. Maybe if you've had lightning hit nearby, you notice maybe your TV flicker or that kind of thing. But what we're really talking about is a high altitude nuclear generated electromagnetic pulse. And by that, I mean somebody detonates a nuclear warhead, probably above about 25 miles in the atmosphere. That generates some gamma rays, which in turn affect the atmosphere, and they affect the Earth's magnetic field and couple into lots and lots of electronics, and we can talk about all that. So the EMP in general is that wave, that electromagnetic wave that propagates down towards the Earth.
Okay, and you said it can be caused by a nuclear explosion at about 25 miles, and it can be caused by natural means, right?
Certainly, that's right. Lots of natural means can cause a minor electromagnetic pulse. They don't usually represent a danger to, certainly not to the infrastructures of the country. There are other weaponized EMPs that are really tactical-type weapons, like a Verkader, for example. They're meant to target maybe a specific military compound, and so while the military is very interested in those technologies because they represent a real danger, you know, the typical citizen in the country, it doesn't pose a threat to them directly. So the ones that most people talk about and the commissions have looked at are these high-altitude nuclear-generated EMPs.
Which you refer to as hemp, right?
Right, that's right. Sometimes they're called hemp.
So what would the scenario be like if, as you mentioned in here, an asymmetric attack were to happen on the United States?
Typical warfare, if you think about it, you have two parties that are relatively equally balanced for them to go to war with each other. And there's a trade-off of damage, right? If one country does something to the other has the ability to retaliate and cause similar damage. Certainly that's true of the superpowers. But an asymmetric attack is maybe a group that is not capable of waging war, but they're able to issue a very devastating, perhaps a single attack that causes a lot of destruction on the other country. And there's no real mechanism by which the more powerful country can retaliate. And that's the case of an EMP attack. If you, for example, had a terrorist organization get a hold of a warhead and a rocketing system and able to launch one of these nuclear bombs, if you want to call it that, into the atmosphere, detonate in the atmosphere, and it would cause widespread damage across the country, which I'm sure we'll talk about. The question then is, what would the United States do about that? Well, maybe they would track the boat that fired it and destroyed the boat, and maybe they would track the terrorists that bought the nuclear weapon and kill them off. But at the end of the day, we would still have suffered trillions of dollars of damage, and the terrorists in the end would have lost a few operatives, perhaps. So it's a very asymmetric attack.
And right in the first part of the book, in chapter one, you say this book is the first in a series focused on high-impact, low-frequency, HILF, events that might result in the end of the world as we know it. And how do you say that little acronym there of the end of the world as we know it?
Oh, I've heard people say it lots of different ways. I usually just say the end of the world as we know it.
Okay.
Otherwise, people don't know what I'm talking about.
Right. I was taking a stab at it. I was thinking Teotihuacan or something like that?
I think most people say Teotihuacan.
Teotihuacan.
Yeah. But nobody, you know, most of the people wouldn't know what that is unless they're in that circle. You know, I had written a couple of books previously, and they're broad-based family disaster preparedness guides. And I always tell people, always start there, because if you and your family are not prepared for commonplace disasters, you have no business jumping into these high-impact, low-frequency events, because they take a lot of preparations and a lot of consideration. So you really do need to learn to walk before you run and get your basic preparations in order. And we can talk to that whatever length you'd like. So this book, though, I have a very specific interest in EMP attacks in particular because of my background in electromagnetics. And so I was able to conduct some hands-on experiments. You know, I had a lot of questions. I had read read a lot of information about EMPs, but I really didn't have the answers I wanted. And so I did the research and wrote this book. And I thought I really ought to make this one of several. I have other interests, like, for example, pandemic preparedness is the next one I'm working on. Things that would really end our civilization the way we know it today. And, you know, what kind of preparations could you take to be ready for those?
Right. And on page 17, you say that the list of events that might result in the end of the world as we know it is long and varied, but can be trimmed down to the following likely candidates: EMP attack, solar storm, and that's what this book was about, pandemic that you just mentioned, natural or man-made, nuclear war, asteroid strike, supervolcano eruption, ecological disaster that causes a widespread agricultural crisis, and global financial collapse. With EMP and solar storms, I guess the most notable historical event that we can look at, besides, as I learned from your book, that Starfish Prime experiment that was in 1962, I think, the Carrington event. Why don't you just give a little background about that?
Sure. Well, the Carrington event is known for being a very powerful solar storm. I believe it occurred back in 1859. And now, this was back in the days of the telegraph system. And they didn't really know what to expect. And it ended up the solar storm was so powerful it caused a geomagnetic disturbance on the Earth that generated very high currents in the telegraph system and caught fire at several stations and caused some injuries and so forth. And the reason people point to it is not that it, you know, destroyed civilization from that one solar storm, but they extrapolate if that storm had occurred today in this very modern civilization, very, very extensive damage to the world's electrical system and how that would ripple around into all of the other infrastructures that we depend on. And most people don't realize solar storms, about every 100 years, the sun emits a very powerful coronal mass emission, which can ultimately manifest down on the Earth as a geomagnetic storm. And that causes these currents, which can cause a lot of damage. So it's about every 100 years or so. And the reason people don't appreciate it is because 100 years ago, of course, we weren't nearly as modernized, or 150 years ago, we weren't nearly as modernized as we are today. So we're really due a very large solar storm, and we'll see if our safeguards protect us from it as well as people think it will or not.
Well, it was a little encouraging to find out from reading your book that the solar EMP is not as bad as the nuclear. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, there's a great deal of confusion about that. And I think it's just because of a lack of basic electromagnetics. People don't work in electromagnetics. And,
right.
But just to make it clear, you know, an EMP strike, like from a nuclear weapon, is a very, what we call a very broadband pulse. And that means it's a very sharp turn-on pulse, which means it has frequency spectrum that's very wide. So there's low frequency content, there's high frequency content. And the reason that's important is that the frequency content determines how well it couples into different kind of electrical systems. So low frequency signals, for example, couple very well into long transmission lines like electrical power lines. High frequency signals, on the other hand, couple very well into smaller electronic systems like radios and things, handheld systems, cell phones and things like that. So
right.
An EMP poses a very broad threat, whereas a solar storm really only generates the low frequency electromagnetic wave disturbance at the Earth. You don't have the high frequency components. So you don't have to build a Faraday cage is the first thing I tell people. If you're just worried about a solar storm, that Faraday cage is not needed. You know, you need to think more about infrastructures that will be disturbed, not about your personal electronics being damaged.
Right.
So they're very different threats.
Right. And of course, for the listeners of Faraday cages, I guess you could even look at it as like a garbage can with a lid on top of it, right? Something protecting whatever it is, an electronic component that you want to protect, like a car or some other sensitive component.
Right. A Faraday cage in general is just a conductive enclosure. It can be a perfect sphere that's made out of metal. It's just something that is a perfect conductive enclosure. We do these makeshift Faraday cages, and one of them oftentimes people build is they'll buy a galvanized metal garbage can, put their stuff inside, maybe line it with cardboard first, put the stuff inside, and put the metal lid on. And I did some testing on that to test the effectiveness of this, and it works fairly well. There's some things you can do to improve that. You can also build your own Faraday cage using aluminum foil. People have done that, and it also does fairly well. But there's some special points you want to build a Faraday cage. The critical piece is you're trying to make it almost watertight. You know, you're trying to keep
right.
any holes and gaps as small as possible. That's the key to having a very highly effective Faraday cage.
Now, what happens? It strips electrons away from molecules and atoms?
Yeah, basically that's right. There's several mechanisms that occur in the atmosphere when an EMP detonates, but in simple terms, yeah, the electrons get stripped away and they circulate down around the Earth's magnetic field lines, and that creates a disturbance at the surface, and that disturbance, that electromagnetic disturbance, couples into electrical systems. The Faraday cage is meant to prevent that disturbance from coming in and causing damage to the electronics.
Right. As a side note, on page 86, you talk about a commercial product based on this concept of a conductive car cover to protect against an EMP pulse currently under development. Has that changed since
published? It hasn't changed. The book is still very new, but there is an interesting story. So when I first wrote the initial version of this, there's no devices that I know of, no techniques anyone has come up with that don't effective at protecting automobiles. So I had an epiphany after I published the initial version that I really wanted to know more about the susceptibility of automobiles, how the signals attenuate going into an automobile. And so I did some personal tests on that. And in the book, you see a picture there of a conductive car cover I built. And of course, my neighbors thought I was crazy because, you know, I was conducting these very strange tests. So, you know, they know me as the odd NASA engineer across the street. And they all had to come over and ask me what I was doing. And, you know, I explained to them. And, you know, indeed, I found that, you know, there's a lot of things to know about automobiles and EMPs. But if you have the ability to put one inside of a conductive structure, whether that's a conductive carport or, like in this case, a conductive car cover, it does a very good job of reducing the field levels such that the electronics, the sensitive ignition electronics perhaps, would not be damaged by an EMP. So that's the good news. The bad news is there's no product like that out there yet. And so my idea was, well, I've proven it works. I'll try and develop a product that people might be able to buy.
Sure. American ingenuity, right?
Sure. That's right.
Entrepreneurship. I mean, if this topic begins to gain steam, you could be educating millions of people at once, which would be great. I wanted to stick with the sun before we get into the other area, but I know from speaking to other experts on EMP and reading a little bit here and there that the solar maximum is expected to occur. Some people say December of this year, and your book says either then or into 2013. I don't know how close of a time frame we're looking at. Are you thinking from December to January? Are you thinking it could happen any time in 2013? And it might not even happen in 2013.
Right. It's a little difficult. I'm not an astrophysicist or anything like that, but these cycles are sort of like sine waves. These cycles repeat about every 11 years or 12 years, and they're difficult to predict precisely. But what we do know is that we're entering the phase of the maximum. And what that means is that there's more activity on the sun, that, and the likelihood of us being affected on Earth is greater. And whether the exact peak occurs the end of this year or middle of next year isn't really the point. The point is that this period of time is a time when we would expect a great deal of activity.
And for some reason, the solar cycle is 11 years.
Right. And we'd have to talk to people that work in that area to explain exactly why that is. The sun is a marvelous thing out there, but it's also very complicated.
Right. And scary, too, because towards the end of the book, you're saying the sun is estimated to be about 4.57 billion years old. And another 5 billion years, it's expected to become a red giant and develop the Earth, destroying all life on the planet.
Yeah, good news, right?
Yeah, right. Great news. But it is, when you think about it, I guess in the much larger scheme of things, it's kind of scary. You know, you think, here we are, we're sitting here talking over the phone, and we could walk outside, it's a beautiful day, but maybe in 5 billion years, there will be no planet.
Right, well, almost certainly there won't be a planet. The good news is we are a very intelligent species, and working for NASA, I can say, you know, we're always looking for opportunities to expand the human race into deeper space. So in 5 billion years, who knows, right? Not something I'm worried about.
Exactly. You were talking about an inevitability that in 5 billion years, we will be gone. This is also an inevitability that we will get a Carrington-type event, but it's not an inevitability that the Carrington-type event would actually hit Earth, right? The CME might not deliver a direct blow to Earth, right?
Oh, that's right. In fact, there's solar flares and these coronal mass emissions, coronal mass ejections, people say it different ways. Those occur all the time on the sun. And in fact, there were several large ones that occurred in the past 12 months that had they been in the direction of Earth, so, you know, there are these large plasma eruptions that occur off the surface of the sun. And if they had come in our direction, we would have definitely had a chance to experience that type of magnitude event. But fortunately for us, they went in a different direction into space. So it is clearly a question of only when, not if, one of these emissions will affect the Earth. They happen, like I said, about every 100 years or so in our direction. And how bad they will be, well, we don't know, because there's no real record of a modern society like ours ever having been affected by a very large emission from the sun. So if you think about maybe a bad event occurs every 100 years, if we call it that, maybe a truly world-changing event occurs every 1,000 years or 10,000 years, well, we would never have seen those as a modern civilization. So the effects of it are still very unknown what would happen.
Right. Now, if something like that did happen, of course, that's the whole topic here in your book, getting prepared for something like this. Because here we are, like I said, we're sitting here in a civilized fashion talking about this topic. But if an EMP event did happen right now, whether from nuclear or solar, it would seriously disrupt the national infrastructure. And the way that you described it was like a domino effect when you said that once the electrical infrastructure went, that would affect everything. Is that right?
That's right. So the electrical infrastructure is particularly vulnerable because we have, of course, these large transmission lines that run all over the world. And their being very long conductors make them very susceptible to pick up electromagnetic energy. That energy then can propagate into the electrical systems and cause transformer damage. And that damage is very difficult to replace. Those transformers, from what I have read, can take up to a year to be fabricated. So you can imagine if a large percentage of the United States electrical system was taken down for a period of, let's even be optimistic and say 3 to 6 months, the world would be a very different place for a period of time. And what happens to the United States really very strongly affects the rest of the world as well. well from an economic point of view. So, you know, everything hinges on that lifeblood of electricity. If it were to start to fail, even if nothing else had been damaged, which it very likely would be, systems would start falling one after the other. The telecommunications industry would fall. Emergency services would quickly fall. Transportation systems. All of our core infrastructures are really linked together. When one goes, the others depend on them for some transactions or some exchange of resources. So they all fall together very quickly.
Right. And what is a supervisory and controlled data acquisition system? Because these are very important, right?
Right. So in the telecommunication industry in particular, although they are used in other places as well, like transportation industry, they have these supervisory systems, these SCADAs is what they call them. And the EMP Commission did some testing to just find out what are the vulnerabilities of some of these different systems out here. And what they found is that a lot of systems that used to be operated by people in the loop are now run by these supervisory control systems. And that's great because, you know, it saves money and they're reliable and all that. But they found, unfortunately, that they're very sensitive to these electromagnetic pulse attacks. And if they start failing, then those infrastructures fall very quickly. And I'm sure, you know, there's been some planning to have backups of these control systems where they could be replaced. But if you had a national level event where it destroyed, you know, 80% of these controllers across the United States, there's no way you could possibly recover from that without a very long period of time. They'd have to be manufactured and brought in and all that. So they represent a very sensitive piece of electronics that are susceptible to the EMP attack.
Right. If it did happen and it was a direct hit, let's say with a CME or some terrorist or rogue state, or even not a terrorist or rogue state. Let's say it was Russia who did it, whoever it might be. They run a trawler right along the East Coast, fire the missile up, explodes over Kansas. You're talking apocalypse, right?
Well, maybe. Certainly our military would continue to function. I would think if a country like Russia initiated an attack like that on the United States, they would be full and well prepared that they would have essentially declared war on the United States. So I think we would see that build up, and that would be part of a broader-based attack on the United States. But I think it's more likely probably that it would be a rogue nation like North Korea or Iran, or it could be a terrorist organization. But yeah, the effects on the United States, if everything went right for the person trying to initiate the attack, they estimate it could be over $1 trillion in damage the United States from a single detonation, that one warhead, and you'd lose all major infrastructures across much of the United States, continental U.S. anyway. And you can imagine, you know, roughly 300 million people trying to figure out how to exist in a nation where all of a sudden nothing worked any longer. So it would be truly, if you want to call it apocalypse, you can.
And on page 67, and this is very interesting, because you say that a great deal of confusion would follow an EMP attack because most people are unaware of the threat.
That's right. I think that's an important point. So you can kind of imagine the scenario, if you would. Now, there's some misinformation or misunderstanding about what the effects might be, but just paint this picture where you get up in the morning, for example, and your house is cold. You don't know why your heater's not running. You go in and you take the cold shower. Your television doesn't seem to work. You don't have any power. But all of this, you're still attributing that, well, there's probably just been a blackout. You go out and maybe you try and start your car and it's running a little funny. It's not idling right. You notice your neighbors are all having similar problems. Still, in most people's minds, they would not be able to put the pieces together to say maybe our country has been attacked by something, because they wouldn't see anything, they wouldn't hear anything, they wouldn't be able to get the information from the government. So there would be a great deal of confusion for a period of time.
Right. Similar to, I guess, when the first plane hit the Twin Towers.
Right. That's right. And I remember that day very well. The initial broadcasts were that this was some kind of accident. They didn't know how it had happened. It wasn't until the second plane hit that it really became clear.
And I was going to ask you about that. That event kind of brought it toward this direction, didn't it?
It did. It was the event back in 2001. I was doing this electronic work and really hadn't thought a whole lot about family preparedness. And when I saw that happen, and I remember feeling as confused and like everyone, not sure exactly what this meant. Was this an attack on the entire country? Is my family in danger? I didn't really understand what that meant. I didn't really understand what preparations I should have in place. That really motivated me to take an exhaustive look at family preparedness. And in turn, that led me to this high impact event and other high impact events that might affect us as well.
And here on page 90, I like this paragraph. You're talking about preparing as an individual, and you say that one significant difference between an EMP attack and other widespread disasters is the potential duration of the event. And you said this just a bit ago. Experts predict that it could be many months before commercial electricity is restored to the hardest hit areas, leaving families vulnerable to a wide assortment of threats, including food shortages, inability to get fuel, limited medical care, lack of clean water, and criminal violence. This implies that a DP plan, which you can explain after I read this, if you will, a DP plan specifically designed for an EMP attack would have large stockpiles of basic necessities, specifically food, water, medicine, and heater fuel, as well as the means to protect one's family. The bulk of the book is really about the DP.
Right. And right. By DP, I just mean disaster preparedness. It's used so often, I just coined the term DP.
Right.
So, yeah, that's where I usually tell people to start, is that, you know, you start by figuring out what it is you're worried about. And if you're worried about basic common disasters, hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes, then you list those out and you figure out, well, what are the impacts that they might cause on me? And then you take some steps to mitigate those impacts, right? If you're worried about losing electricity, for example, you might have a generator and, you know, very basic preparations. In the case of an EMP attack, the problem is exactly what you stated, which is that the duration of these impacts are potentially very, very long. And you can imagine a particularly poor weekend or maybe even a week long without power. You can manage it, but it becomes very uncomfortable after a short period of time. You can imagine that if that's stretched out to 6 months or 9 months, it's no longer about inconvenience. It now becomes about survival. And so you have to have a DP plan or a disaster preparedness plan that's really targeting all of your basic needs for a long duration, for maybe up to a full year. So in the book, I have a little table in there that outlines the 14 basic needs and just some summary of the preparations that you might consider to meet each of those needs.
Right. And of course, you do have a handbook also, don't you?
That's right. So I have a much larger book that's sort of a compendium of lots of information about disaster preparedness, and that's the Handbook to Practical Disaster Preparedness for the Family. And it does include a little introduction because I think this is such an important topic. It includes an introduction to EMP attacks and solar storms. But most of the book is about each of these specific needs, the food, water, shelter, communications, electricity, all of the basic needs we know we need. It talks about how to meet those needs through a variety of crises and what kind of preparations make sense.
Right. Dr. Arthur T. Bradley, author of Disaster Preparedness for EMP Attacks and Solar Storms, the Expanded Edition, and other books, I want to thank you so much for the time you took out of your day explaining all this to the listeners, and looking forward to your next book, and looking forward to talking to you in the future.
Well, thank you for having me and allowing me to talk about this important topic.